65 and older. Online registration requested for a quicker on-site processing. For those that are not able to register online, will be rerouted to a waiting area to register before vaccination. Wear short sleeve clothing, easy to access arm. Bring a valid driver's license or other photo ID. To pre-register or for more information, visit mchodessa.com. For those looking for a way to help, email volunteers@odessa-tx.gov. Odessa Regional Medical Center, 520 East 6th Street, is expecting COVID-19 vaccines soon. The vaccine is free of charge while supplies last. Please check on vaccine availability. For more information, call 432-582-8549. That's 432-582-8549. Or visit tinyurl.com/Y3JQHZ89. Walgreens has limited COVID-19 vaccines available in select areas. For eligibility requirements or more information, visit tinyurl.com/YHR6NEUD.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 22 and snowing. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low in the upper 20s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 30s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper teens. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Good afternoon. Welcome to your coronavirus update for Friday, February 12th, 2021. I'm Michael from the Recording Library of West Texas. One note, I will be taking off most of Thursday and all of Friday. So our reports this Thursday and Friday will be pre-recorded reports from the Texas Standard and a few reports from NPR. One thing I do want to note is that as of Thursday morning at 10 a.m., the CVS pharmacies in Texas are now accepting appointments. The website is very busy, so you may have to wait a while. For updates and information, as well as to book an appointment, you can visit cvs.com. You can use the CVS pharmacy app, or you can call CVS at 800-746-7287. Once again, that number is 800-746-7287. Looking at the status of the CVS website insofar as which cities are fully booked and which are available, the good news is most of the cities in West Texas at 10 a.m. on Thursday, February 11th, are still available for booking. That includes Midland, Odessa, Lubbock, Abilene, and San Angelo. We will return with our regular format for this program on Monday. Now, here are our pre-recorded reports.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. We've done a lot of reporting lately on the distribution of COVID-19 vaccines in Texas, and we've heard mostly from officials and journalists across the state about what's working and what's not. But when we took to the Texas Standard Facebook page recently to ask how the process was actually going for listeners, we really saw just how much of a range of experiences there are. Texas Standard's Laura Rice is trying to track some of those experiences in a new project.
We sent a call out for your COVID-19 vaccine stories, and some of you responded.
Hello, my name is Doug Rainey, and I am 60 years old, and I live west of Fort Worth, Texas. I am a frontline healthcare provider. I have been doing this my whole adult life. The first 10 years as an EMS, as an EMT and a paramedic. and then for the last 26 years as a certified registered nurse anesthetist.
That means Ramey is an airway expert, and he knows about the devastation COVID-19 can cause. As a healthcare worker, he should be at the front of the line in Texas, and he says he was.
Through a link, I was able to find the local HEB pharmacy, not very far from our house, and I called them on Christmas Eve and made an appointment for the 26th.
Easy as that. And then for his second vaccine, he got a text to schedule and then a follow-up call for an appointment that same week.
So that process went very well and smoothly, and I'm pleased with how it worked. And I would hope that something similar would be set up for the general population.
But it has not at all been so easy for everyone.
My name is Edwina Beatty. I'm 77 years old. I'm a widow living by myself in San Marcos, Texas. I have high blood pressure, asthma, arthritis. I'm also on a waiting list at my primary care doctor's office, and I've registered at San Marcos Health Department. I check drugstore sites daily on the internet. I also check CVS, Walgreens, HEB, my hospital here in town. I'm frustrated, and I'm worried I won't get vaccinated as soon as possible.
Across the state in El Paso, 40-year-old Jamie Baird has similar concerns.
I have allergic asthma, and I take more than one controller medication, which includes an injectable twice a month. I want the vaccine as I fear that if I were to contract COVID-19, that it would be fatal. I've registered with my county and primary care physician, but the process is just too slow. El Pasoans are hearing that second doses won't be administered until March, while many El Pasoans haven't even received a first dose. My personal skepticism really tells me that for myself and the others in my community, we will not get a first dose until July, given the lack of available vaccines, but I really hope I'm wrong.
In Austin, 67-year-old cancer survivor Tom Phillips also feels this frustration.
And I went to the AustinTexas.gov login page and signed up and tried to register, and it tells me that there's no vaccines available at this time and won't let me even sign up. And I've done this for several days, and every day, of course, it says there's nothing available and it won't even let me get on a list.
He's considering a workaround.
I was talking to my brother up in Denton, and he said, oh yeah, we can sign up, and then when there's one available, it sends you a text message. So I just went and signed up for the Denton County website. It took me like minutes. It was not confusing at all. And I'm going to just drive up to Denton to get a shot, because the Austin-Travis County website is a joke.
He has mixed feelings about the whole process and how it's being handled in different parts of Texas.
I'm pretty frustrated to have to drive 250 miles to get a shot. But I'm going to do that because now I know I'm on a list. I just got a text message on my phone saying I'm on the list. Pretty cool. Just trying to get this shot to make sure that I don't get hit hard. We have several people I know have gotten it, and some people parents have passed away, so I think it is important everybody get vaccinated. Thanks a lot.
We want to keep this project going, but we need your stories to do so. If you're currently eligible to get a COVID-19 vaccine in Texas, how's your experience been? You can record your story directly for the radio by going to texasstandard.org/vaccinatingtexas. I'm Laura Rice for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard.
Whether it's about the virus or the vaccine, we want to find answers to your questions about COVID-19. Throughout the pandemic, we've been collecting your questions and bouncing them off Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and an associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard, and Happy New Year to you, sir.
Well, Happy New Year to you too, David.
The first question that we have for you comes from listener Katie Fisher. She has a question about the vaccine rollout in Texas. Katie asks, will Texas preschool teachers be eligible for the vaccine at the same time as other teachers? What do you know about that?
Well, I know that there is some uncertainty about how states will prioritize their vaccine candidates, but so far, Texas, for instance, seems to be following the CDC recommendations, and their panel has made recommendations that prioritize teachers school workers and child care workers. And so it sounds to me as if this listener is likely to be included in that priority group.
I see. Well, now, we've been hearing quite a bit about this new strain of COVID-19 from the UK that's apparently more infectious than the version that we've been dealing with so far here in Texas. And as we've reported here, just last week, the first case of this new strain was found in Harris County. So are there any additional or different precautions you think Texans might need to take in order to stay safe from this new strain of COVID?
Well, you are correct that it appears that the newer strains have mutated and are more infectious, in other words, more likely to spread better and faster. However, that means that the usual good common sense measures, such as social distancing, masking, hand washing, all the things we've been talking about, are going to be even more important to continue. Of course, vaccination is also effective against these strains at the present time. There have been studies to confirm that. So vaccination with our currently available vaccines, again, are an excellent way to minimize spread.
So I guess the message, as I hear you, Doctor, is don't just keep it up, but maybe step it up.
Absolutely. The sooner we get to herd immunity point, the more likely we are to be able to return to something like a normal activity. And the best way to avoid serious complications, of course, is social distancing, masking, and then vaccination.
One of the things about vaccines, and in particular the COVID vaccine, is the great deal of disinformation that has been out there on social media and the internet more generally. And we received a few questions, Doctor, about possible links between the vaccine and infertility. Is there any data that you're aware of to suggest that this COVID vaccine might cause someone to become infertile or perhaps to have complications with pregnancy?
Well, I am not a specialist in obstetrics and gynecology, but having said that, the news seems to be very good about infertility. There has been no evidence of infertility problems. Of course, it may take a considerable period of time to be certain about that.
And more specifically, what about pregnancy, Doctor?
Again, it is very important that women in childbearing years consult their own personal practitioner about the vaccine, but the news so far has been good, and the vaccine has not apparently caused any serious complications in pregnancy.
Best thing to do, though, talk to your personal practitioner about this.
Absolutely.
Dr. Fred Campbell is a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio, and he's been joining us regularly over the course of this pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something you'd like to ask the doctor about the virus or the vaccine, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus, and you'll find a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again, and thanks again for your expertise.
Thank you. It's great to be of help.
You're on Texas Standard Time.
Throughout the pandemic, rural communities in the Panhandle have been hit particularly hard by the coronavirus. Early on, they faced limited testing supplies and personal protective equipment. Then, last fall, many hospitals ran out of hospital beds. Now, they can't seem to get vaccines into arms fast enough. Texas Tech Public Media's Jamie Lozano follows one man's journey to a vaccine.
Let me call. Let's see what it'll tell me. Let me see. When was it I called? Yesterday. I know I called yesterday. I was trying to get in for a second appointment.
Manuel Mendez calls the Lubbock Health Department to check on his second dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. It's still too soon for him to book his next appointment, but he needs to start making calls now.
All first-dose COVID-19 vaccine appointments for the week of January 25th are now full. The city is working with the state of Texas and the Texas...
Although his age doesn't qualify him for a shot, he's 58, he has diabetes, high blood pressure, and coronary heart disease, which does qualify him.
I'm just trying to protect me, and especially Mom. You know, I mean, I live here with her. I'll be moving out in June, Lord willing.
Open heart surgery left him unable to work, so he lives with his mom. His health conditions, combined with his mom's age, she's 80, makes him anxious to get his final vaccination. Also, his mom refuses to get her shot. He hasn't found a place to get vaccinated in Loveland, so he makes calls to Lubbock, the area's medical hub. But that has also been a struggle.
Why they're using Selectacy, I have no idea. I really don't, because it sucks. You try to get in there, and it throws you somewhere else, and it wants you to buy tickets for basketball. Come on, really? So I got lucky, and I just kept calling and calling and calling, and I got in.
Manuel is one of few residents in Loveland to receive a shot. According to state data, as of January 29th, little more than 250 Hockley County residents, which includes Loveland, have been fully vaccinated out of a population of 23,000. And most vaccines, according to health officials, have been administered outside of Loveland, in Lubbock. A few days ago, when he finally landed an appointment, Manuel drove 25 minutes to Lubbock Civic Center, where dozens of people stood in line for a vaccine.
You don't have to stand in line, you can just go to your left if you have an appointment.
For many, this is their best and really only option.
I think the frustration for the rural areas is that we don't have any idea as to when we'll be allocated vaccine or how much.
Back in Loveland, Bruce White, CEO of Covenant Hospital, says the facility has received 200 doses of the Moderna vaccine, but he doesn't know when another shipment might come in.
You know, we just don't know when we're going to get it. We kind of sit on our hands. There are several rural hospitals that have yet to receive any vaccine. It's hard to really understand the state strategy on how they're rolling it out. You know, I know there's obviously not about enough vaccine to go out all at once, and so it is what it is.
Data from the APM Research Lab ranks Texas as 30th among all states in immunizing its population, with just 5.2% vaccinated as of January 24th. White said there are plans for a mass vaccination event in Loveland if they ever receive enough doses to pull it off.
We have lots and lots of people, you know, calling for the vaccine, and how do we do this, and how do we get signed up, and that kind of thing. And you know, the answer right now is advocate for yourself. Get the vaccine where you can get it.
That means getting on the phone like your life depends on it. I'm Jamie Lozano in Loveland, Texas.
This is the first story in a year-long collaboration with Frontline, the PBS series, through its local journalism initiative.
33 minutes past the hour, it's Texas Standard Time, and I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. The Dell Medical School at UT Austin has been testing out a program that could help combat the health effects of loneliness and isolation, particularly among older people. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports public health officials say loneliness has become a growing public health concern that is more urgent during the pandemic.
Didi Diaz is calling up a man named Earl. He's in his late 70s.
Hello.
Hi, Earl.
Yes.
Hi, Earl. This is Didi.
Yeah, Didi. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Well, doing pretty good.
Didi and Earl haven't talked in a bit, so there's a lot to catch up on. One of Earl's granddaughters recently got married. Another granddaughter had a baby. It came a little early, he says. He also talked about a small medical procedure he had recently. It went well. The conversation then turns to weather. It's getting colder, so the leaves from the trees around his yard are starting to fall. Earl tells Didi about that, too.
I've got an ash tree in front, so I've been dealing with it.
Okay.
And then the neighbor's kid. In the backyard, the neighbor's trees, they blow in my yard.
This call is like any other conversation you hear between friends, except it's a little more one-sided. It's mostly about Earl. It's about what has happened in his life, what he's thinking about, what his days are like, including the most mundane details. Didi started these calls with Earl as a volunteer for the Sunshine Calls program. This program serves older adults who are often homebound and therefore pretty isolated in their daily lives. How often they get a phone call varies depending on the person. And the point of the calls is to get these individuals to just talk about themselves.
The focus is really about making the person on the other end feel that it is a time of their own, that it is a time of their priorities, their choices, their interests.
That's Minnie Callon. She's the executive director of Factor Health at Dell Medical School, which is a lead in this project. She says the program uses empathy as a sort of medical intervention for people facing loneliness and isolation. Callon says these simple conversations can eventually, hopefully, have a big effect on how people feel about their own lives.
And in that way, make them feel for that moment, and hopefully it carries forward, that their past matters, their present matters, and what they feel about the future matters.
This project is a partnership between Del Med and Meals on Wheels of Central Texas. Meals on Wheels is a national group that distributes meals to older Americans. Adam Hauser is the president and CEO of Central Texas's chapter. He says isolation has been an issue among the people they serve for a long time.
It's not uncommon for many of our clients, if they didn't have a daily visit from Meals on Wheels volunteer, they wouldn't see anyone else.
Hauser says isolation and the depression and anxiety that can be caused by isolation has been a public health concern for a while now. But he says the pandemic has been like sort of an x-ray on this problem. Hauser says everyone can just see it a little clearer now.
I guess you could say this is one of the sort of good things to come out of the pandemic, is that people are starting to realize that older adults have very complex and significant needs.
And Minnie Callon with Del Med says these needs have become greater and more urgent during the pandemic. So far, the program has already served more than 100 people.
There's absolutely no question that with COVID and the increased isolation of folks, the interest in loneliness has ratcheted up. No question about it.
Callon says that's why Del Med also began conducting a study on the program. Researchers checked in with people between July and September of last year. They measured whether these sunshine calls had made them feel less isolated, less left out, and like they had companionship in their life. Callon says if they can prove these calls made measurable differences, it could be a useful tool in the fight against isolation.
It's one of several potential solutions that will then be available to folks as they think about how to intervene, not just screen for and recognize that the issue exists.
Adam Hauser with Meals on Wheels says it's more important than ever for people to tackle this problem as a major public health issue. He says isolation can affect someone's physical health as well as their emotional health.
Loneliness and depression and feelings of isolation, in our view, are viruses just like COVID, and can have just as devastating health impacts, particularly on seniors and older adults.
Del Med researchers are currently working to get the results of their study published as soon as possible so the program can be replicated elsewhere.
In Austin, I'm Ashley Lopez. You're on Texas Standard Time.
For some COVID-19 patients, a negative test does not mean they're done with the virus. It's called long-haul COVID, when symptoms like chronic fatigue, respiratory problems, and brain fog can persist for months after contracting the virus. Although doctors know more about long-haul COVID than when the pandemic started, there are still many questions about its effects. For more, we turn to Dr. Esther Malamed. She is an assistant neurology professor at UT Austin's Dell Medical School. Dr. Malamed, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We spoke last fall about these folks who experience symptoms from COVID-19 months after they first contract the virus. Do you have a better idea now about how prevalent this is?
So, David, there have been studies looking at patients at a couple of weeks, at 3 months, and now the most recent study has looked at patients at 6 months post-COVID. And it appears that this is still very much of a prevalent condition, even going out to 6 months for folks. Mm. And the main symptoms that are experienced include fatigue and headaches, pain. There are persistent neuropsychological symptoms, and we are still learning about this syndrome, but it certainly does appear that even out to 6 months at this point, folks are still experiencing symptoms.
Now, what separates those whose symptoms persist for so long versus everyone else, or those who seem to get over it in pretty short order?
It's a very interesting question, David. So comorbidities such as obesity and high blood pressure, diabetes, or mental health all seem to predispose patients to a higher risk of getting COVID, as well as to ongoing long-term symptoms. However, It is interesting that even patients who were asymptomatic or had mild disease during the acute COVID infection still continue to have these long-term post-COVID symptoms. And so it is not just the patients who were in the ICU and who had multi-organ damage to the heart, lungs, and the brain that can determine long-lasting symptoms. There's definitely something that we're still not completely understanding in terms of what other effects there may be on the body by the virus in those who may have had mild or even asymptomatic disease.
Well, we've been hearing so much of late about mutations of this virus. Is it possible there could be a particular strain to blame or something else entirely?
That's also a really good question, and with every new finding, there are 10 new questions that are raised, and
right.
Now that we have learned, we're learning about the different strains of the virus in Great Britain and in several states in the United States and several emerging in other countries, it is certainly the case that some of the strains may predispose to different symptoms. The other possibility that my research team in collaboration with other immunologists and physicians at Dell Medical School are studying is whether there is an emergence of autoimmune diseases post-COVID, and perhaps that may be one of the factors that could explain why people with mild or asymptomatic COVID may continue to experience symptoms post-COVID.
Do there seem to be any distinctions between groups of people when it comes to long-term effects of COVID?
Yes, so we're learning that men are predisposed to getting a more severe disease, but interestingly, women seem to be outnumbering men at a ratio of 4-1 in terms of presenting for long-term COVID symptoms. And it's unclear whether this is a true genetic difference or environmental difference, or it may be that women are seeking care more often than men are. Another question that we will, I'm sure, continue to learn about as we investigate post-COVID syndrome in the coming months.
Obviously, we're going to continue to keep an eye on that research at the Dell Medical School, UT Austin. That's where Dr. Esther Melamed is an assistant neurology professor. Dr. Melamed, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Time now to turn to your questions about COVID-19. We've been asking you to send in whatever inquiries you might have about the pandemic or the vaccine, and we're going to get some answers from Dr. Fred Campbell. He's a doctor of internal medicine and associate professor of medicine at the Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio. Dr. Campbell, welcome back to the Texas Standard. Good to have you, sir.
It's great to be back, David.
All right, so this first question comes to us on Twitter from user Sam. Sam asks, I haven't had a primary care doctor in years since the vaccine is a two-part jab. Will it be available at pharmacies like the flu shot, or will folks need to have a primary care physician to get the vaccine?
Well, Sam is correct that historically flu shots and other vaccinations have been administered in pharmacies under the authorization of that company's medical director without necessarily a medical home. So he should be able to do that under the COVID-19 as well.
You do have to, as I understand it, you do have to go back in for a second shot and make sure it's the Pfizer vaccine, not some other brand, right?
That is correct, and that might be a very difficult record-keeping process, so I can't tell you with certainty how that's going to be maintained.
This next question is from an anonymous listener who asks, I've heard the Pfizer shot is particularly painful because it has to be administered at such a low temperature. Are you aware that that's the case, Doctor? I believe I've heard that the vaccine has to be held at something like negative 70 degrees Celsius.
Well, the vaccine itself is always thawed to a liquid form before administration, so it will be above the freezing point. So the temperature at the time of the vaccination is probably not going to affect any pain or other problems at the site.
I see. Well, that is probably comforting for a lot of folks to know, people who think that it might be injected at a super cold temperature. That's not the case, it sounds like. Another question related to the temperature of that Pfizer vaccine, this one from Thomas Nugent, who asks, should we have more faith in the Moderna vaccine becoming more popular since it doesn't have to be stored at such a low temperature like the Pfizer vaccine? I mean, could that low temperature requirement affect efficacy and distribution as you see it, Dr. Campbell?
Well, I'm confident that our distribution system is going to deliver any vaccine to fairly remote areas without much problem. I understand that these vaccines can maintain their potency under refrigeration for several hours. So although it might be very difficult to have people that are very remote vaccinated, I know that that's feasible with these vaccines.
I was trying to think of another situation in the U.S., at least in recent memory, that might be a parallel when it comes to ramping up for the mass inoculation of Americans. I was thinking maybe polio, perhaps the polio vaccine back in the 1950s. Can you imagine any parallel? Just how big of a logistical issue is this going to be moving into January of 2021?
Well, I am old enough that I actually helped participate in the vaccine project with polio. I was a Boy Scout back in the '60s when we were giving out sugar cubes with the Sabin oral vaccine. So it was a project that involved people coming into schoolhouses, to churches, to other places, and lining up for long periods of time to get their vaccination in oral form. So that was my first experience with a big vaccine campaign, and of course it has virtually wiped out polio in the world at this point. We're getting very close.
Dr. Campbell, one other quick question. I was thinking about the timeline here. It was about March, I recall, when the nation began to go on lockdown. Tell me, come March 2021, where do you think we're going to be with this vaccine and the pandemic at large in Texas?
Well, there will be hundreds of thousands of people safer in some respects because of being vaccinated by that time, particularly our highest risk individuals, the elderly and infirmed who are institutionalized, and of course our frontline workers. I don't think that March is likely to be safe for most of the population, however, that have not been vaccinated and would still need to do all of the common sense things we've been talked about, including social distancing and wearing a mask, until much later in 2021.
Dr. Fred Campbell is a doctor of internal medicine at the Long School at UT Health San Antonio. He's been joining us regularly over the course of the pandemic to answer your questions. Now, if you have something you'd like to ask the doctor about virus or the vaccine, look for us on Twitter, Facebook, or go over to texasstandard.org/coronavirus. You'll find a form there to submit your questions. Dr. Campbell, thanks so much for joining us again. Good to talk with you, sir.
It's always great to be of help.
And this has been your coronavirus update for Friday, February 12th, 2021. Stay tuned for the magazine Entertainment Weekly, followed by national news with USA Today at 2, and our local news broadcast with our papers in Odessa and Midland at 3. And then more news from the Wall Street Journal at 6. Finally, tonight at 7, as always on Fridays, we bring you some lighter news and funny readings from On the Lighter Side. That's tonight at 7. Thank you again for joining us, and have a great weekend. We will be back with our regular program. We will be back with our regular program at 1 o'clock Monday afternoon.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 24 and snowy. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 30s. Then, tomorrow clear with a high in the low 30s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the upper teens. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.
Thank you for listening to Enable This Week. I know it's the middle of winter, and I know you probably don't really want to go outdoors, but soon the weather will get better, and you'll be eager to get outside and enjoy what nature has to offer. Today you'll find out about outdoor accessibility on trails in New Hampshire, on a beach in Florida, and in our national parks. I'll start with an article from the Sierra Club, and I will give thanks now to my Reach Out Radio colleague, Kathy Van Skyke, for sending me this article. It's from the SierraClub.org website. The headline reads, Accessibility for the Blind, a Burgeoning Movement. Braille Trails, Sensory Gardens, and More. The article was written by Stacy McKenna, was published in November of 2020. Whether he's hiking in his beloved White Mountains or ascending a distant peak, Randy Pierce pays attention with all of his senses. He listens to the wind as it whistles through a ravine or rustles in a stand of American beech trees. He lets the fragrance of a forest, as it becomes dominated by pine, tell him when he's reached an elevation milestone. With one hand on a trekking pole and the other on his guide dog's harness or a friend's backpack, Randy Pierce feels the ground and focuses on the shifts in his partner's movements to anticipate roots or rocks in his path. Even the air on his face provides clues about his environment, he says. Here's a quote. "People who have been blind all their life are better at it than me, but I can walk along and I can feel when I am close to a massive tree because the air pressure changes. Or I can feel when I'm close to a glacial erratic because of the temperature change." At the summit, Randy Pierce visualizes the sweeping views his companions describe, relishing in the fact that he gets to see such vistas through multiple sets of eyes. And on cloudy days, he often can tell those same friends what would be in their sight line if the skies were clear. That's because he prepares for his hikes by tracing raised relief maps with his thumb while listening to descriptions of the landscapes. Although an estimated 32.2 million adults in the United States identify as blind or unable to see or experience difficulty seeing even with corrective lenses, many nature-based experiences remain difficult to access for blind and partially sighted individuals. Some of these barriers are physical. Nature-based experiences often require venturing into geographically isolated places, which of course becomes especially difficult for individuals who depend on public transportation. And once there, people who are blind or partially sighted may grapple with additional challenges, says Christopher Dixon, Youth Program Manager at the Center for Visually Impaired in Daytona Beach, Florida. Seemingly simple endeavors like navigating new terrain or finding a trailhead can be tricky in the absence of accessible information. Here's a quote from Christopher Dixon. "If you haven't had proper mobility training at that location, where do you go? How do you get around? What's there? Where are things?" Dixon says it's hard to get there. And once you get there, it's hard to get around if you haven't been there before. Some of this is challenging. Across the country, networks of what are called Braille trails include educational placards in Braille, guidelines to delineate the path, and tactile walkways or smartphone-accessible audio tours. Things that are called sensory gardens explicitly take the experience beyond the visual, incorporating plants that make strange sounds, have unique scents, or are appealing to touch, or can be tasted. In recent years, the National Park Service has added audio guides and brochures at dozens of its parks and is slowly working toward improving transit options in some areas. You will hear much more about this topic later. The article continues, "Still, even with some concrete obstacles out of the way, personal and intrapersonal obstacles continue to keep many blind and partially sighted people from embracing the outdoors." Megan O'Connell Kopp is an adaptive physical education teacher at the Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, Massachusetts. As she introduces her students to sports and outdoor activities, she finds many of them have internalized others' perceptions of their limitations. That's what she said. After Randy Pierce, the man from New Hampshire, lost his vision at the age of 22, the result of a neurological disease, he quit hiking and climbing for nearly 20 years. It wasn't until his condition worsened, temporarily landing him in a wheelchair, that he started to think about the outdoors again. As he worked with a physical therapist to regain his ability to walk, she sought out creative ways to challenge him and inspire him. One day, she encouraged him to try using a hiking stick in place of his more stable quad cane. Well, in 2009, 4 years after he began the process of getting his feet back under him, Randy Pierce was hiking again, in earnest. By August of 2013, he had summited all 48 of New Hampshire's 4,000-foot peaks in both winter and summer, and he had his sights set on adventures from the Grand Canyon to Kilimanjaro. For youths who, unlike Randy Pierce, may not have fond memories of the wilderness adventures to motivate them, innovative programs are still opening doors. In 2016, Perkins unveiled an accessible park adjacent to the school along the banks of the Charles River. The paved path, marked by a guide wire and dotted with braille markers at points of interest, such as the sensory garden or canoe-shaped benches, this paved path gives students the chance to explore independently and using multiple senses. In Central Florida, the Young Sound Seekers program, started earlier this year, introduced a group of blind and partially sighted students, most of whom had never been to a national park. The Young Sound Seekers program introduced them to the soundscapes of Canaveral National Seashore. The NPS-funded program is a collaboration between the Atlantic Center for the Arts, Daytona Beach's Center for the Visually Impaired, and Stetson University in that area. It aims to give the youth a real-life opportunity to hone practical skills, such as navigating unfamiliar ground, and introduces them to nature in their own backyard. You'll hear more about this program very shortly, too. This article continues, though, by saying, at its core, the Young Sound Seekers teaches students to interrogate their environments using sound. At the program's second in-person meeting on a Saturday, the group gathered in the shade of a live oak canopy at Seminole Rest, listening to bird calls, listening to squirrels scrambling among the branches, a breeze whispering through the moss, even a jet rumbling overhead. Guided by Stetson University Professor of Digital Arts and Music Technology, Nathan Wolek, participants described what they heard and discussed the role that sounds play in the ecosystem. In a modified version of the National Park Service's Time Machine exercise, they imagined what it might have sounded like when the indigenous Timquan people were shucking oysters and tossing the shells into the area's nascent middens 3,000 years ago. And in case you're not familiar with that word, middens, the area's nascent middens, this is an ancient garbage dump. That's a good way of describing it. That's what the Timucuan people were doing, shucking oysters and tossing the shells into the area's middens 3,000 years ago. They were imagining that. Using senses other than vision is fundamental to the way blind and partially sighted people experience the world, Dixon explains. We use our hands, here's a quote, we use our hands and our fingers to look and see and feel, he says, adding, listening is just another tool for understanding what's beyond our fingertips. Thus, expanding nature-based resources in ways that showcase an array of sensory experiences is an essential part of making those spaces more welcoming to individuals who are blind or partially sighted. It's also an important way, in our visually oriented culture, to expand how typically sighted visitors perceive the outdoors. Now we'll switch to another article. As mentioned before, this information came from the Daytona Beach News Journal. Their website is news-journalonline.com. The article was written by Abigail Mercer, and it was published in October of last year. The headline reads, Learning to Listen. Blind, low-sighted students benefit from the Atlantic Center program. We're going to Florida now. Here we go. Hang on. Bird calls, crashing waves. Many find relaxation in the sounds of nature. For children and young adults with visual impairments, those sounds can also be a valuable way to get information about the world around them. As part of a 5-year, $300,000 grant from the National Park Service's program called Natural Sounds and Night Skies, the Atlantic Center for the Arts is partnering with Stetson University and the Center for the Visually Impaired to create what they're calling the Young Sound Seekers Program. The 10-month program includes excursions to Canaveral National Seashore, dedicated to learning about sound ecology and expanding the students' view of the world around them. Dr. Nathan Wolak, professor of digital arts and music technology at Stetson, works on the curriculum for the project. He is focusing on teaching active listening, as well as helping the students expand their vocabulary about the world around them. Here's a quote. "There's a difference between hearing and listening. Hearing is a more passive activity, and listening is much more active. You're taking those sounds in. You're assessing them," Wolak said. "It was really neat to have a group of people, 11 in all, and be the only people on the beach for about a mile. We really listened to the sound of the waves crashing against the shore, the smattering of birds flying down, the sound of the grass on the dunes fluttering in the wind, just layering that groundwork for future excursions." Those future excursions will happen once a month until May, and each day out at the Canaveral National Shore will work students toward their end goal, creating an audio-focused podcast to listen to on the park's mobile app. Instead of pointing out visuals such as the types of birds or trees, Dr. Wolak said the podcast will be geared toward blind and low-sighted people. Already, Wolak said, he's been impressed with the students' skills. While he often has to explain to his university students the difference between sound and noise, a word that has a connotation of unwanted sound, these young sound seekers did not have that problem. He said, "I've been teaching at Stetson for 16 years now, so I've had plenty of experience. It's a common topic in some lectures to talk about the difference between sound and noise. But this group didn't even talk about that," he said. "For the first time in my 16 years, I had a group of students that did not conflate the words sound and noise in our initial conversations." Eve Payor, Director of Community Programs for the Atlantic Center for the Arts, called this project a labor of love. "Between teaching the students about environmental conservation and helping them expand their vocabulary of the world around them, it's something Payor thinks can make a real difference for the students." Here's a quote from her. "I find it's important for us to explore the subtleties of life," she said. "One of our goals is to provide these students a safe environment where they can enjoy listening to these sounds, just to enjoy them and have a moment, instead of doing so because they need to." And while students listen to their surroundings for enjoyment, Payor said they can take the opportunity to teach them about the environment and the problem of sound pollution. "Trying to communicate, whether it be for mating or looking for food, has become increasingly hard for animals," Payor said. She compared it to trying to shout across an increasingly busy highway. Here's a quote. "It's so important to understand our place in the ecosystem. We can learn stories and map sounds just by listening," she said. "The stressors of different sounds are well documented. People can get illness from too much noise, and that translates to wildlife, too. It gets hard for animals to communicate with the noise pollution. It can stress them out." Rone David, CEO for the Center for the Visually Impaired, this is in the Daytona Beach area, Rone David said the program, which is focused on students aged 14 to 22, is going to be a large step toward getting them ready for college or careers. Here's a quote from her. "This is helping them to provide skills that they need to become self-sufficient," David said. "The students are really enjoying it. It's so wonderful for them to get outside and learn and be in the parks and experience this." Payor said the pilot project for this 5-year grant will be a benefit to both the students taking part in the program and the community around them. The article ends with a quote from her. "The real important thing for us to give the blind and partially sighted community is to make them feel welcome and to allow them to contribute to the community by telling their stories. It's really about giving them independence. Now, you should know, even though we're in the middle of winter, that this article is accompanied by a picture showing the students gathered on a weathered wooden boardwalk. It leads from a grass-covered sand dune to what seems to be an endless stretch of empty white sand beach. The ocean is a vibrant turquoise blue. White foamy waves are gently coming up onto the beach. There's another picture with this article that shows the students gathered under a spacious pavilion with an arched roof. Two students are sitting at each picnic table, facing the instructor. Behind the instructor, there is a view of the ocean. And for those of us in more northern climates, please note that there's no snow in these pictures and the sun is out. This is from Daytona Beach, Florida. And once again, this program was called the Young Sound Seekers, sponsored by the National Park Service in collaboration with the Atlantic Center for the Arts, Daytona Beach's Center for the Visually Impaired, and Stetson University, all in the Daytona area. Earlier in the program, I mentioned that in recent years, the National Park Service has added audio guides and brochures at dozens of its parks and is slowly working toward improving accessibility options in some areas. Well, I've picked out a few areas to take you to and have a look, see what's going on. So here's an example of what the National Park Service is doing. Information comes from their website, nps.gov. We're using Cape Cod as our first example. The headline or the section reads, Blind, Low Vision, Accessibility, Learn and Explore. They have a lead-in paragraph that says, much of Cape Cod National Seashore is accessible to those who are blind or have low vision. In addition to the accommodations listed below, vision-impaired and audio-only versions are now available of the main park brochure. Cape Cod National Seashore and many other National Park Service sites now have full audio-described versions of their main park brochure. The brochure is available in text only, audio only, and an interactive text and audio app for both Android and iOS Apple devices. Some of the points that they make here, there are 9 of them. They have large print versions of official park publications. These are available at the Salt Pond area, this is in Cape Cod Park, or at the Province Lands Visitor Centers and at the park headquarters. They also mention there's the Button Bush Trail near the Salt Pond Visitor Center. This trail has guide ropes and braille signage. Next we have they claim that there is a braille translation of the park brochure. It's available for use at the 2 visitor centers and at park headquarters. The next point they make, the 4 park movies shown at the 2 visitor centers have been audio described and assistive listening devices are available. The next thing they want you to know, the lobby exhibits at the Salt Pond area and Province Lands area have tactile features. And at the Wampanoag exhibit in the Salt Ponds Museum, there are phone sets for audio messages. The next point, crosswalks at the Salt Pond have tactile markings. The next point, exhibits follow visual accessibility guidelines for color, contrast, font, and point size. And the next point they make, Province Lands Visitor Center has a tactile floor plan available. And the actual exhibit's gallery is described for people who have low or no vision. And the final point they made here is that web content is accessible to screen readers, and social media posts include hashtag alt text. Another possible destination if you're doing this national park tour is the Statue of Liberty National Monument in New York Harbor. Information Center is located a short walk from the boat dock. Liberty Island Information Center offers visitors a narrated movie about the statue's history. The volume of the film is adjustable by the ranger. The park brochure audio-described text for the Statue of Liberty National Monument is available as a Word document. There is a braille-ready park brochure available to use. and there are two tactile displays within the Information Center. We come to Ranger programs at the Statue of Liberty. All Ranger programs strive to engage multiple senses and learning styles, and often include audio components and or tactile objects. Ranger-led tours are offered year-round and are outside on the grounds of Liberty Island, which has brick walkways. There is little elevation change. Some walkways slope slightly. Most walkways are a minimum of 10 feet in width. The Statue of Liberty Museum is there too. Located past the Information Center on the left, the Statue of Liberty Museum is accessible by two ramps. Located on either side of the building, or one flight of stairs, the museum includes a narrated 10-minute movie, three interactive galleries, and restrooms, all located on one level. Throughout the museum, visitors can use the self-guided audio tour, which is available with headsets and volume control. A descriptive audio tour is also available for visitors who are blind or have low vision. There are several tactile displays within the museum for visitors to touch. And this is at the Statue of Liberty Museum at near the Information Center on Liberty Island. There are also, they mention, audio tours. An audio tour program is available in a variety of languages. It includes historical accounts on the construction and design of the Statue of Liberty. The audio tour program can be used as a guided tour around the perimeter of the monument and as a narrative to artifacts located within the museum. Audio descriptive tours, created specifically for people who are blind or visually impaired, are available free of charge from the pavilion located near Liberty Island Information Center. And then we go inside the monument. Visitors with pedestal reservations will have access to various levels of the pedestal. Visitors with crown reservations will have access to the various levels of the pedestal and in the crown of the statue. While visiting the Statue of Liberty, emergency warnings and fire alarms are equipped with strobe or flashing lights. For a detailed description of how to navigate within the monument, you really need to go to their physical mobility within the pedestal page for more details. Now, I also found on the National Park Service website information about service animals. And this applies to all of their parks, but in this case, some of the information is specific to the Statue of Liberty Park. The section is called Service Animals, How Service Animal is Defined. Service animals are defined as dogs that are individually trained to do work or perform tasks for people with disabilities. They are working animals, not pets. Examples of such work or tasks include guiding people who are blind, alerting people who are deaf, pulling a wheelchair, alerting and protecting a person who is having a seizure, reminding a person with mental illness to take prescribed medications, calming a person with post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD during an anxiety attack, or performing other duties. The work or task an animal has been trained to provide must be directly related to the person's disability. Dogs whose sole function is to provide comfort or emotional support do not qualify as service animals under the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA. This definition does not affect or limit the broader definitions of assistance animal under the Fair Housing Act, or the broader definition of service animal under the Air Carrier Access Act. Some state and local laws also define service animals more broadly than the ADA does. The next section is called Where Service Animals Are Allowed. And remember, this is pertaining to the Statue of Liberty, but there are certain things like this for every national park. Where service animals are allowed. Service animals are welcome in all areas of the park except for access to the crown. This is at the Statue of Liberty once again. Assessments have determined that allowing service animals on the crown stairway poses a legitimate threat to the safety of the disabled handler, to other visitors in the crown, and to the service animal itself. Visitors who wish to make arrangements to leave their service animal in a portable kennel during their visit to the Crown should contact the Statue of Liberty Park officials at least 2 weeks prior to their visit. Now, the next point I'm sure applies to all national parks. Service animals must be under control. Guests who use service